Welcome to the Hospice New Zealand Genesis Oncology Trust Lecture number 3. Our thanks to Genesis Oncology Trust for their continued sponsorship, which allows us to bring you these lectures. This morning, there will be a presentation followed by a question and answer session. And I must advise you that this conference is being recorded, and at this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Our speaker today is Dr. Peter Fleischl. Dr. Fleischl has been in full-time general practice in Taupo for 25 years. He has also been actively involved in medical student education and in 2010 completed a Master of Clinical Education. We are delighted that he joins us today to share his expertise in palliative care and general practice. Welcome, Peter. Please go ahead.
Thank you very much. And thank you to Hospice New Zealand for asking me to speak today. And also thank you to Peter Wilford, Dr. Peter Wilford in Auckland, who handed me this hot potato. Now, firstly, as a matter of introduction, yes, my name is Peter Fleischl. I'm a general practitioner who's been working full-time in Taupo for the last 25 years with the full support of my wife, Kirsten, and daughter, Laura. For the past 15 years, I've been involved in clinical teaching of fourth-year medical students at the Auckland Medical School, and general practice registrars as part of the Royal New Zealand College of General Practice training program. For the past 15 years, I've also worked as Primex examiner for the college and am presently assistant censor. In the mid-1990s, I took 3 years to complete a diploma in geriatric medicine. I did so in response to the increasing demands and complexity of geriatric medicine and my love for the elderly as a group. As the challenge of teaching medical students and registrars tested my resources, I enrolled in the Master of Education program at Auckland University, which I completed 2 years ago. For my dissertation, I analysed the results of an online survey that was constructed and sent to 414 senior general practice registrars, questioning their attitudes to training and working in palliative care teams. I was introduced to palliative care by my patients, and it has become a large interest of mine. My involvement in palliative care has been made possible by the support of the local palliative care team, which has grown from strength to strength over the last 25 years. Slide 2, an overview of today's presentation. In today's talk, I shall describe the journey our local palliative care team has taken from its inception to where it is now. I shall describe the ways in which palliative care has become woven into my general practice. I shall provide some data relating to my last 89 palliative care cases in Taupo over the last few years, and will reveal the results of the dissertation survey. Finally, I wish to pose some questions about all these matters. Now, slide 2. So, background to Lake Taupo Hospice. The Taupo palliative care team has grown in the last 25 years, mainly in number. The service was seeded in a public meeting in 1981. In 1983, a volunteer organisation was established, and this group formalised their membership with Hospice New Zealand in 1985. The function of this group was to support families and health professionals in whatever way they could, with very few resources. In 2004, following a generous bequest, a house was purchased at 7 Sunset Street, Hilltop, in Taupo, for the purposes of establishing a home for the organisation. Slide 3. In 2005, a meeting between stakeholders formulated a vision for hospice and palliative care services. That year saw the appointment of the first palliative care coordinator. This signalled the first move from a volunteer-led to a professionally-led organisation. A partnership approach was adopted with general practice. In 2008, the Lakes District Health Board first funded a palliative care specialist service to the southern half of their region, which, by the way, accounts for one-third of their population base. In 2012, Lake Taupo Hospice took over the contract to provide a 24/7 palliative care nursing service. As of the 1st of December 2005, The service had 32 patients on its books and had received 72 new referrals in the previous 12 months. As of the 1st of December 2012, 7 years later, the service had 60 patients on its books and had received 152 new referrals in the previous 12 months. 7 Sunset Street, Taupo, is the administration base for the hospice, with care coordinators, an administration manager, manager of volunteer services, all working from that address. The house is also known as home for the Tuesday Club, a very popular day care program, the Art and Craft Group, the Ko-Fi Bereavement Group, and various activities such as massage therapy, relaxation classes, and creative writing. There is also room for equipment storage and meeting rooms for service coordination and education purposes. Lake Taupo Hospice is remarkable for its large number of volunteers. All GPs in town are encouraged and supported in their palliative care efforts in a partnership model. Lake Taupo Hospice now operates as a service provider for 24/7 nursing and multidisciplinary service for patients and their families. Nursing staff have close training links with Health Waikato, and palliative care specialists visit Taupo from Hamilton on a monthly basis to see patients and conduct in-service training and support. Slide number 4. Here's a photo of some members of the Lake Taupo Hospice, ably led by clinical leader Susie Cooper. Susie is a strident advocate for her team and misses no opportunity to sing the team's praises from as high a vantage point as possible. Slide number 5. She not only advocates, but coordinates, negotiates, educates, and facilitates a wide number of stakeholders, team members, and the wider community. She is one of those rare people who is able to get all parties to sing from the same song sheet. Slide number 6. Now to move on to my interest in palliative care. In the early years in Taupo, I was approached by the local hospice committee and was offered assistance to attend the hospice conference in Nelson. The year I went was the year that Professor Robert Twycross was the keynote speaker. Now, he was fantastic, and I heard from him for the first time the true essence of what palliative care was all about. It was a very important experience, which fueled my interest in palliative care from then on. The support given to me to attend the conference by the local group was very much appreciated, and I feel very humbled by their generous assistance. Slide number 7. The most important trigger for my palliative care interest is the ongoing relationship and expectations built up with my patients in the course of looking after them for many years. General practice is a journey we choose to take with our patients right throughout their lives. It is just assumed that we will be there for them when they have their final illness. In small town New Zealand, the general practitioner has a large role to play in this respect. Few specialist services are available to share care with, and in this setting, higher levels of illness complexity are managed in general practice. Slide number 8. I am not alone. General practitioners in established practice have expressed a desire to deliver palliative care services to their patients and communities. A recent cross-sectional survey of 168 rural general practitioners showed that 98% provided palliative care, and the mean number of palliative care patients seen by each GP in the previous 12 months was 7.3. Patients value the ongoing input of their general practitioner, which has been shown to improve the quality of their end-of-life medical care. Slide number 9. Colleague support is essential for general practice palliative care. I have been very fortunate in that all of my partners in general practice, 7 in total, actively provide palliative care services. Here's part of our team on the day. From the left, Dr. John Mowat, Tim Coulter, myself, and Dr. David Nixon. Going away for weekends and holidays is made possible by having a formalized system of handover between partners As I tidy up before leaving, I print out a summary of the patient's illness, treatments, and supports. I discuss the case with the partner I'm designating to take over in my absence and make clear the level of input and presence needed based on the individual circumstances of the case. As we all take roughly equal amounts of leave, it works equitably with no problem. Slide number 10. Our practice nurses are our eyes, ears, and heart of the practice, along with the reception staff. They see our patients for innumerable problems and often give us warning of problems developing. One of our more perceptive nurses, Dale Byers, once commented to me that the fit young 48-year-old man she had just seen looked a little bit pale. I got him in, as it turned out, he was developing an acute myeloid leukemia. Other interactions between practice nurses and our palliative care patients involve receiving and conveying messages, prescriptions, administering various treatments, including anti-androgen therapy, bisphosphonates, intravenous infusions, and intravenous antibiotics. They are frequently involved in helping patients and their carers access other supports in the community and other services. Frequently, just being able to spend time talking with a carer when they come into the surgery is the most valuable activity. Slide number 11, please. Our reception staff are our window to the outside world. Their warmth and enthusiasm, tempered with an appropriate concern for the patient's welfare, differentiate our staff from any other business in town. One of our typists, Madeline Ridley, has for as long as I can remember taken it upon herself to send a condolence card to the family of patients who have died. It is a highly valued gesture. Slide number 12. No general practitioner can do full palliative care without a collaborative multidisciplinary team. No case is too difficult with the assistance of your colleagues. I've learned to refer my patients to Lake Taupo Hospice early on in their illness to cement in the supports and pathways of care that need to be fleshed out before they are really needed. When patients and carers have a clear understanding of the challenges ahead and a view of the faces who will help them in their moments of need, then life is less frightening all around. The growth and development of the Lake Taupo Hospice has given me enormous confidence in the ability of general practice to contribute to ongoing service delivery in Taupo. Hospice and palliative medicine specialists will recognize that a growing primary palliative care practice, far from competing, will enable the discipline to flourish. I receive wonderful backup, advice and support from the team of palliative medicine specialists in Hamilton. There is always someone available on the phone to discuss any problem and to give timely and realistic advice. Slide number 13. The nature of the general practice consultation is complex and ever-changing. More palliative medicine is entering mainstream medical practice as our population ages. With our younger patients, much of our work is about cure and primary prevention. Into middle age, the content of the consultation is cure with elements of primary and secondary prevention. As our population becomes significantly age-enriched, elements of palliation creep into the consultation alongside secondary prevention and diminishing degrees of cure and primary prevention. Various problems are dealt with in each consultation, and each one will require varying degrees of cure, primary prevention, secondary prevention, and palliation. Palliative medicine doesn't just start all of a sudden. It enters aspects of care, patients' care over many years. As I am a partner in my practice and a joint owner in the premises, I enjoy the freedom to take my practice to the patient in ways that many locums or salaried GPs may not. There are instances where taking ownership of the patient and her problems is required. Typically, this occurs when the patient's illness is progressing and there are several agencies and subspecialities involved in patient management. The GP has a special role in coordinating care and advocating for the patient. On many occasions, I've arranged family meetings in the surgery or at the home to take stock, inform people, advance care where the patient is falling between the cracks created by distance, time, and communication delays. In this situation, the patient may be feeling abandoned by secondary services, perhaps after someone in clinic has said that there is no more treatment we can offer you at this stage. When I see my patients in this situation, I like to find out who are the vital support people and encourage the patient to accept the help that these people will provide, along with the other members of the palliative care team. Keeping this nucleus of people informed, motivated, and prepared is the real challenge for the general practitioner. It is a time when I offer the primary carer my home and mobile cell phone numbers and invite them to ring me at any time to discuss anything that is causing them concern. Whenever they call me at home, if my wife answers the phone, she asks them whether they are a palliative care patient. Other patients who ring home, she efficiently directs to the on-call GP or the ambulance, but all my palliative care patients get direct access to me. Surprisingly, this offer is hardly ever abused by them, and in fact, I'm really the first person called when the situation is changing. The hospice nurse usually deals with things appropriately, and I hear about it later. Only once did I have the son of one of my previously deceased patients ring me on my cell phone a year later to make an appointment to have his driving license examination. This is the only time I can remember my number being used inappropriately. Much of the palliative care I deliver is within patients' homes. Towards the end of many patients' lives, I pop in and see them at home several times a week, depending on the circumstances. The nurses of the Lake Taupo Hospice take the lead with care, and we consult in a collaborative manner, respecting each other's areas of expertise. Though there are no scheduled patient management meetings that I'm involved with, my path is crossed by the palliative care nurses many times during the week. We catch up with each other on the phone, the fax, in the surgery, in the hospice rooms, at meetings, and over discussions regarding medical students. Most importantly, we meet in the homes of our patients, where our presence is most appreciated. Slide number 14. Patient charges. Patient charges in New Zealand are a barrier to general practice care. This was clearly identified in the evaluation of the Health West Palliative Care Program in Auckland, conducted by Dr. Allen and Vivian Adair and Professor Gregor Costa in 2008. The true costs to general practice of providing palliative care services are very high. In the palliative care setting, it is an unnecessary burden on patients, challenged with both their illness and challenged support systems. Funding for our palliative care work comes through an ongoing source channeled through our PHO. It provides adequate remuneration for my time and additional resources. The fund pays for an initial patient registration with hospice, and ongoing payments are conditional on active collaboration with the local palliative care team. There is a scale of payments which enables me to freely visit my patients in the rest homes and in their homes. There are reporting requirements attached to the payments, but they are minimal. Though we do have access to Genesis Oncology lectures, Waikato Palliative Care Grand Rounds, and occasional talks from visiting palliative care specialists, there is no compulsory medical education requirement for receiving the service payments. The Royal New Zealand College of General Practice Maintenance of Ongoing Professional Standards Program requires GPs to complete an annual professional development plan. This living educational plan is actively reviewed every year and provides a platform for each practitioner to structure their ongoing continuing medical education and reflection in a way that is most relevant to their chosen areas of interest. Slide number 15. So, I now have a practice size of 2,200 patients, of whom some are flirting with terminal illness, some are being bundled into a cancer treatment pathway, some are becoming cancer survivors, and others are on a steady decline towards death. When I think about it, my role is very much like that of an air traffic controller. There are 2,200 aircraft of various descriptions flying about, expecting me and the other members of the palliative care team to facilitate an orderly and civilized landing. Some are merrily flying about, quite oblivious to the issues of landing. Others are striking varying degrees of turbulence due to adverse weather, or doing a Qantas wobble as bits fall off the fuselage. Intermittently, the odd one will fall out of the sky and crash land nowhere near the runway. Then there is the slow trickle of patients on their final approach, getting ready to land with our careful and coordinated assistance. On the metaphor of coming down to earth, I have two more images which may resonate with some of you. Slide number 16. This one comes under the heading of permission. And slide number 17. This is under the heading of patience. My work in palliative care brings significant meaning to the rest of my general practice. One can be judged by the manner in which one treats the most vulnerable members of society and their families. Patients are slow to forget the manner in which their loved ones passed away and the quality of care that was delivered to them during that journey. I find that the remaining spouse and family commonly appreciate the opportunity to talk about their lost relative at different times during both illness and health. This ongoing support of families in their bereavement can be a comfort and a healing force when employed with care. We all have a responsibility to pass on our processed thoughts and experiences to the next generation of health professionals. I feel that this is a part of our duty of care. In so doing, we are looking after the next generation of patients. So with that in mind, I regard my practice like a vast casket of wonderful treasure into which I let my medical students gaze, marvel, and learn from. They recognize that it is a magical learning opportunity, and I have no right to lock it up, protected from their eyes and minds. Palliative care teams are sitting on treasure. Now to move on, looking at my last 89 cases. To present a review of my last 89 cases might suggest that I am well organized. I can assure you I am not. To obtain this list, I did something very unscientific and went to my narcotic drug register and looked at all the patients who appeared on the list and who had had a significant terminal illness during the requiring the assistance of the palliative care team. I excluded those patients who moved out of the district before death. Also, one could assume that there will be patients who were never prescribed narcotics who will not appear in this data. Slide number 18. Firstly, to look at the major causes of death, consistent with national data, cancer of the lung, colon, breast, prostate led the group, with an overrepresentation of cancer of the pancreas and lower esophagus. According to the Cancer Registry 2009 New Zealand data, lung cancer accounted for the most deaths from cancer in 2009, roughly 19% of all deaths from cancer. Colorectal cancer was the next most common cause of death by cancer, followed by breast and then prostate. For men, the most common cause of cancer was lung cancer, 20%, followed by colorectal and then prostate. For women, the most common cause of death in New Zealand was cancer of the lung as well, 18%, followed by breast and then colorectal. The slide here doesn't include all of the patients. Next slide, please, number 19. The non-cancer deaths also closely follow the national averages in terms of type of disease. These patients tended to belong to an older age bracket. Slide number 20. Looking at where my patients died, overall, 60% of deaths occurred in their homes, 35% in rest homes, and only 5% in hospital. Slide number 21. Of the cancer deaths, 80% died at home, 17% in the rest homes, and 3% died in hospital. Slide number 22. For non-cancer deaths, only 23% died at home, 73% in rest homes, and 4% in hospital. Slide 23, please. Place of death for cancer sufferers has been studied by many researchers. Good quality palliative care can help people achieve their desire to die at home. Costantini identified that the rate of death at home in cancer sufferers in Genoa in 1990 was 33% and was twice that rate, 60%, in users of a home-based palliative care service. Barbara Gomez and Irene Higginson, two prolific palliative care researchers, raised concerns in 2008 on a meta-analysis of place of death data in the UK obtained from 1974 to 2003. They projected likely trends right through to 2030. They revealed that over the study period, the proportion of home deaths dropped from 31% down to 18% overall, and that an even higher rate for people aged over 65, women, and non-cancer deaths. They projected that fewer than 1 in 10 people would die at home in England and Wales by 2030. The proportion of deaths occurring at home in my data is high for the cancer group and, consistent with other groups, was lower for people with non-cancer deaths. The determinants of whether one will die at home are well known. One has to have a home, and in most cases a spouse or a family to care for you. A lot depends on which society one is born into and what family structure and function exists. The extended families of my Maori and Polynesian patients reliably provide wonderful care for their members in my experience. Being very old, female, and having a non-cancer illness can also count against any plans to die at home. Having a good palliative care team on board can increase your chances, and I would maintain that having your GP involved in your care can also help in this regard. The cancers which involved younger patients included cancer of the breast, melanoma, cancer of the esophagus, liver cancer, and angiosarcoma. There are a few other rare ones. These cancers had an average age of death in the 40s and 50s. From a personal perspective, the journey taken by these patients was in many ways more challenging than with the very older patients. The impact of loss of a parent on a younger family is immense and deeply felt by the whole palliative care team. In my general practice, the effect of these losses is measured every year afterwards as the affected families make sense of the loss and grow from it. Now, to move on to looking at the results of the survey from the dissertation. Slide number 24, thanks. With the help of Professor Jennifer Weller and Boaz Scholroff at the University of Auckland, a dissertation was planned as part of the Masters. Slide 25. It involved an online survey designed to answer several questions. I wanted to reveal general practitioners' attitudes to palliative care in general practice and their attitude towards the palliative care team. Across the various domains in palliative medicine, for example, communication skills, pain control, control of non-pain symptoms, use of syringe drivers, and bereavement care, I wanted to know where they were confident and where they lacked confidence. Knowledge and actual performance in these areas, however, were not specifically measured. I also wanted to find out what they thought of their palliative care training so far and their attitudes towards interprofessional education. I also wanted to invite their opinions on ways of improving their palliative care training. Along the way, I was interested in whether there were any significant differences in the opinions of international medical graduates compared to their New Zealand-trained colleagues. Slide number 26. Why do this study, you may ask? Well, several reasons. The global aging of the population, people are living longer, palliative care would appear to be a growth industry. The demographics of the general practice workforce is changing and gives us concern. With the move towards more part-time work, locum work, and development of various subspecialities, the Royal New Zealand College of General Practitioners needs to further develop its palliative care curriculum to meet society's and the profession's changing needs. Slide 27. A review of the literature revealed a few background truths. Firstly, as previously mentioned, GPs do have an important role to play in palliative care, according to many researchers. Barriers to involvement are well documented and involve issues of time, compensation, training, and health services support. Younger GPs working as locums and part-timers in corporate practice have less opportunity to gain experience and develop their skills in palliative medicine. This demographic is increasing as practice ownership loses favour with young GPs. Patients like to have their own GP, who they know will be committed to them and available for the remainder of their lives. GPs cannot provide comprehensive palliative care without the involvement of the palliative care team. Interprofessional education is a well-researched tool for training and developing the skills of the palliative care team, and many researchers have identified significant gaps in the palliative medicine training of GP registrars. Slide number 28, please. The methodology used for this study will be familiar to many of you. Because of the large number of study participants, an online survey tool was used using surveygizmo.com. And this was chosen over a postal method. An ethics approval was sought from the Northern Regional Ethics Committee and granted. Following the literature search, the research questions were refined. Stakeholder consultation involved discussions with experienced general practitioners, palliative care specialists, GP registrars, and other researchers. With the assistance of Professor Weller and Boaz Scholroff, a questionnaire was developed and piloted on a group of GPs and registrars. This revealed some technical issues and question ambiguity, all of which were remedied. The questionnaire was subsequently released online and collected for analysis using SPSS software for the quantitative data. Thematic analysis with the assistance of in vivo software was employed for analysis of the qualitative data. Slide 29, please. We got 166 respondents out of 414, which gave us a response rate of 40%. Slide number 30. Of the respondents, the majority were women, which reflects the composition of the registrar group. 52% obtained their undergraduate training overseas, and 25% had derived some postgraduate training overseas. Slide number 31. On the question, the first question, does the general practitioner have a role in providing palliative care? The vast majority thought the GP should be involved. Slide number 32. When it came to confidence in the various aspects of palliative medicine, communication skills scored significantly higher than syringe driver and bereavement care issues. It has to be said that communication skills is a very important and prominent part of the general practitioner training scheme. Slide number 33, please. 59% of respondents felt that they belonged to a palliative care team, and 25% stated that they had been to a multidisciplinary palliative care meeting. The most commonly stated reason for not attending such meetings was lack of time. Slide 34. The most preferred palliative care teacher was the palliative medicine specialist, followed by the palliative care nurse and the hospice medical officer. The GP colleague limped in fourth. The only significant differences between the attitudes of international medical graduates and New Zealand graduates was observed when considering education and who they would ask for help in various areas of practice. International medical graduates were more likely than their New Zealand colleagues to choose a geriatrician to deliver their palliative care education and to ask an oncologist or a geriatrician for assistance regarding a medical problem or syringe driver issue in a palliative care patient. These differences may reflect the health service configuration in their country of origin, though this was not specifically explored. There may be a case for a greater orientation of international medical graduates to the function and composition of the palliative care team in New Zealand. Slide 35. Regarding interprofessional education, 7.8% stated that they had been involved in palliative care interprofessional education. Just under a half of respondents would choose a mixed professional group education meeting rather than meeting with boring old doctors. Slide number 36. The questionnaire asked some open questions regarding palliative medicine education and ongoing practice, which proved fertile ground for a lot of chunky commentary. Several themes gained prominence, and I shall illustrate them with some quotes. The three themes are here: the structure of training, enablers and barriers to training, and finally, interprofessional collaboration. So I'll just flick through these and give you enough time to read the quotes. Slide 37, please. Lack of structure. Slide 38, self-motivation. Slide 39, experience. Slide number 40, gaps in learning. Slide number 41, support in early practice. And slide number 42, interprofessional collaboration. Slide number 43, please. The study had numerous limitations. First was the lack of time and funding. The second is that it didn't actually measure what general practice registrars know or actually do in terms of palliative care practice. The other big unknown is the knowledge, skills and attitudes of the large number of non-responders. Slide number 44, please. So, putting it all together, what do the quantitative and qualitative elements of this study tell us that we did not know before? Slide number 45. Firstly, we confirmed that New Zealand general practice registrars believe that the general practitioner has a big role to play in palliative care. Secondly, they value and mostly understand the role of other members of the palliative care team. They would prefer to be taught about palliative care by members of the palliative care team rather than their general practice teachers. Lower levels of confidence in syringe driver and bereavement issues was recorded, and the professionals they would look to for help in these areas were not their general practice teachers, but other members of the palliative care team. There may be an unmet need for greater interprofessional education in palliative care in their training. There may be an unmet need for orientation of international medical graduates to the workings of the palliative care team. And finally, their training in palliative care needs to be better structured, and more serious thought should be given to greater involvement of other members of the palliative care team. And now, slide 46, which raises in my mind the big questions. Will the GPs of the future get the training and experience they need in palliative care? What role does the palliative care team have in providing this? And what initiatives will increase the involvement of general practice and practitioners with the palliative care teams? And with that, I'd like to thank you very much for listening and hand over to the group for any questions. Thank you very much.